Feast of Fun first began in 2005, when there were only about 50 podcasts in the world, and most of them were people doing Sex and the City episode recaps. 16 years and 3,001 shows later, there are millions of podcasts participating in the great conversation of life, love, and viral memes. To celebrate this milestone, we're flipping the tables, and we are the guests on our podcast.
Today, our good friend, Kirthy Fix, is interviewing the best guests in the world, us. Kirthy is best known as the on-camera producer Kirthy from the MTV series Teen Mom and for creating documentary films that examine the creative lives of LGBTQ musicians. Our roots with Kirthy go way back to the 90s performance art scene in Austin, Texas, where drag queens wore dresses and wigs made out of aluminum foil, and smearing your naked body with stuff was all the rage.
Listen as Kirthy grills us about our life before the podcast, our breakup, reconciliation, and eventual marriage.
Plus, lots of fun and emotional stories from our past and new pathways for happiness and fulfillment.
Ah. Oh. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
3001!
Get it!
Oh, it's been gotten.
Hello, Feast of Fun headquarters. This is Fausto.
And Mark speaking.
Hi, guys.
Is you this ready Kirthy?
You ready to chew some fat?
Kirthy!
Hi, Kirthy.
Hi.
So good
How
to hear
are
your voice.
You, handsome man. I know, you too. I'm calling you from the beautiful, warm December weather of Austin, Texas, where we first met.
Oh, and where we got married, too, one of the places.
And where you got married, yeah, where we got group married. Let's start some rumors, shall we? where I'm taking care of your grandchildren.
Oh, I have grandchildren?
In our group marriage, yes.
Oh, my God, what are their names?
Fenton and Willa.
That was some really white Anglo-Saxon names for children of a Puerto Rican
bougiest,
man.
They're the bougiest little bitches. I have to spank them every day because they're so spoiled.
Now, I'm children are not grandma. For hitting.
Yeah, and people are children too.
I spank with my mind.
Oh, that's a really intense experience.
To spank with the mind, yeah.
That actually hurts more.
Have you ever been mind spanked? It does hurt more. It's humiliating.
Well, actually, I said this to my manager at work, and I said this to my husband. Because we value your opinions more than ever, when you're joking around or being playful, sometimes we don't know. And when you say, and you express your anger and frustration, it hurts, it cuts deeper. So please be careful.
Oh, yikes. So I got to be careful on this call? Whoa.
Well, you always have to be careful. Children are listening. Well, actually, I really do value your thoughts and opinions. And for people who are tuning in or who are listeners of Let's Grow Big Together, our new bodybuilding podcast, you can thank Kirthy Fix for getting Muscle Worship Bill on the show. Because Kirthy and I were talking, Kirthy and I talk about all you guys.
Facts. That's a fact.
Facts.
Yes.
And I was like, on the fence, I was like, I don't know if this guy is going to be good. I'm worried that he's going to be kind of weird or and stuff. And you were like, I want you to talk to that muscle worship guy.
And that's got to be your first show.
Yeah. Did I see? I don't even know what I say. I just always love good stories that. You know, secret hidden histories. The three of us have always enjoyed that. The weirdos and the outcasts, because we're kind of weirdo outcasts in our own ways. Mm. And yeah, we started that way in Austin, being goofy performance artists. And, you know, we were all, Mark, this is before you and Fausto got together, but we were kind of groupies of Linda Montano, who was an incredible performance artist who taught at UT for a while, University of Texas.
Tell my favorite story of Linda Montano to the audience?
So describe her first. Yeah. For people who don't know, we're talking about, you know, and if you're younger, we're talking, this is the 90s. I got here in like 1990. Fausto, you were raised here in Austin.
No, I was not. No, San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I
when
came
did you get here?
A year before you in 1989.
Okay.
To college.
Okay.
To college, yeah.
At the age of 17. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
16, 17.
So it's the 90s in Austin. It's kind of sleepy, kind of psychedelic, kind of, you know, boozy and music-y and like low-key. There's always been a weirdo queer vibe that was, because there's a lot of like tolerance and just, I don't know, the love of the eccentric that is part of the Southern tradition. So this is the world. And then Linda is brought in to teach at UT. I didn't know who she was until Angry Women came out, which was an important research publications book that basically profiled all these amazing women, mm-hmm, like Linda, mm-hmm, like Diamante Galas, all these incredible artists I'd never heard of. And so Linda, but she's not, Annie Sprinkle was in that book, and they interviewed her for the position as well. And, you know, so we were all excited about who was going to come teach at UT and kind of, because UT is kind of conservative and the art department.
Extremely conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, you have like right-wing Christian fundamentalists teaching you silt screening.
Yes.
Tim High was his name.
I mean, yeah, that's there too, like, yeah, football rules, like there are all these kind of dichotomies existing. And Linda comes in and did a presentation on her work, and like she did a year-long performance where she was tied to another artist by a foot-long rope. And, you know, she's just a bizarre, amazing woman, very connected to Fluxus and the sort of Dada, like that is, that, those are our influences. So go ahead. What's your story about Linda?
People always like, who's Linda Montana? Why should I care? Mm-hmm. You know? And I'm, mm-hmm, like, before reality television kind of, mm-hmm, dominated everything, Linda was somebody who in the 1970s was saying that, you know, your artwork and your life could be the same thing.
Yes.
And her message, art equals life. And, mm-hmm, to sort of demonstrate this, she was, I believe there is floating out there a tabloid, you know, news show like Entertainment Tonight that covered her being tied with a 6-foot rope to her former lover, I believe the Japanese American artist Tashin Hei.
Did they do it while they were dating?
They were broken up. They broke up.
They broke up and then they did it.
And talk about, you know, manipulating your ex to stay with you.
It's kind of like this podcast, huh?
Never.
I remember asking her, like, because I was like, what would you do? She's like, oh, we'd go to movies and stuff. And I'm like, what would you do if you had to go to the bathroom? She's like, it was super annoying because you'd have to get up and go out and go into the men's room.
And I believe it was originally Tashin's idea. And Linda was like, perfect. He has no idea what this entails, you know? And she was, Linda said to me at one point in time, she was very much in love with him.
And they did this for a year?
They did live together, yeah, for a year. And Linda said one time, she's like, I said, were you ever tempted to like cheat? And she said, yes, all the time, because he was very sexy. And she would be like, let's fuck. No one needs to know. And he's like, oh, no, Linda, no, deal? Please, no, don't touch me.
That was part of the deal. They couldn't have sex.
They couldn't do anything. They could not touch.
Oh, God.
You know, Linda. That's, yeah, that's traumatic.
So what did we learn from that experience?
Well, it was an examining, you know, it was a performance art piece about understanding the relationships that we place upon ourselves and how important it is really to be able to touch somebody, especially somebody that you're intimate with.
I mean, Linda was the first person I knew who just wanted to do some weird thing and she would just do it and call it art.
Yeah.
And that gave us so much permission, I feel like, in, you know, we started the performance art church and we had, you were in, Soft men. Hard women, soft men. All one word. All one word. I mean, we were just doing these weirdo things because, yeah, it entertained us. I don't think we had a lot of theory.
Linda behind had, it. Linda had a strong Roman Catholic background. Didn't that also inform much of her art?
Totally. The ritualism, the self-flagellation quality.
And didn't she almost become a nun or something? Or she was a nun?
Yeah. She did.
Was she a nun? Or what? I never got that part of her story straight.
I don't think she actually became one, but I think she was considering it. And then that later piece she did where she went through, wasn't it 7 years? And each year she would dress in a different color of the chakra.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, like chakras in Eastern belief system is the energy centers of the body. Mark, which one's the money chakra?
The green one.
Is that isn't it your vagina's the money chakra, yeah. Right?
Well, because
that's red.
Because if you got a vagina, you got some money.
She actually did me the biggest honor one time when she was doing a performance. She wanted a different artist to come speak into a microphone for an hour. It was a 7-hour durational piece. And she wanted a different artist to do each chakra. And she picked me to do the root chakra. I described all my sexual experiences.
I had to speed up at the end.
I know. I had to speed up at the end. I mean, I was still in my 20s. So.
That is true. Like, you know, when we were in our early 20s, we would do performances where we'd talk about every single person we'd ever have sex with. This is before social media.
Yeah. There was privacy. Like, it was just the people in the room.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
I have been recalling, talk about a difference in generations. I was recalling a performance piece I did called Butter Breast Lickin' Doggies at Spider House here in Austin. And it was for a show. Me and Tara Vamos were performing together. And we, you know, it was for a show that was titled Manifesto. And so we were very much kind of saying F you to ideas of, you know, white masculine straight ideas of manifesto and patriarchy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And
men so on Fausto?
Manifesto. Oh.
Manifesto. Oh.
Tell me more.
I know, right? And so we showed up all, of course, there were all these dudes reading their manifestos, and me and Tara show up, both with big boobs, and we proceed to, she's playing violin, I'm playing accordion, and then we would stop playing and we would sit in someone's lap, take off our instrument, we're topless, and then David Avery came in a tux, tap dancing with some tuna butter, handed it to us, released my two dogs in lingerie, and we would rub the tuna butter on our breasts and the dogs would run over to us and start licking happily. And it was all about the innocence and purity of sexuality, and like, you know, it's not mutually exclusive to be an intellectual and to be sexual. I told this to my niece recently, who's 25. She with no irony asked me if I had gotten the dog's consent. And that is the difference. Like, you could do stuff like that in a kind of privacy. And what was your most outrageous performance?
Let's talk about the tuna butter real quick, because I like the mechanics of art sometimes. So what was tuna butter?
It was literally warm butter mixed with the water from a tuna can, because because butter alone didn't quite excite the dogs.
And that actually influenced this podcast.
Yes.
It did, yes.
So I was devastated that I missed that. And what's interesting, too, is that the press was there and photographs of this made it onto Interview Magazine or one of those like New York City.
Spin Magazine.
And I was like, damn, I wanted to see that, you know, I wanted to be there. And so I was asking you, I was asking Tiana, I was asking Skip, everybody about it. And Skip Shirey played for me, you guys had a theme song for it.
Oh, we did.
And I learned it.
You did?
Would you like to hear it? Ready?
Yes.
Butter breast licking doggies. Yeah. That's all it was. And so I was like, this is brilliant. I really love the riff. It's very catchy. Mm-hmm. Let's hear it again one more time. Butter breast licking doggies. Yeah. And so For a long time, we would ask our, especially the celebrity guests, a series of 20 nonsensical questions.
Is it 20 or 10?
20 questions. Okay. And I said rapid fire at the very end. So, and what do you see Oprah Winfrey doing 5 years in the future?
was one of the questions.
And so we're like, breakdown 2007. Yeah.
It's that was the theme song to the breakdown.
To the breakdown. So we stole that. And
I love it.
And we're like, we would ask them every stupid interview question, like Barbara Walters, if you could be a tree, what kind of twee would you be?
And I think, one that was most divisive was like, what would you want to see Oprah doing in 5 years? So people, it was the most polarizing question because people either loved Oprah or they absolutely detested her.
Yes.
And it was, and sometimes you'd be really surprised by who really hated Oprah. Yeah. The one thing that I don't know if I would ask again, the question was, if your vagina could speak, what would it say? We asked that of the men. And Margaret Cho, I think I liked her answer the best. She's like, probably something about the sea.
Yeah. Margaret Cho gave us really good answers to the question because she was very guarded. Uh-huh. In the beginning of the interview, because she didn't know who we were, you know?
Yeah.
She
was
like, didn't know how cool we were.
She's like, who are these shock jocks?
And it was probably her first podcast.
It was her first podcast. A lot of people's, it was their first podcast, you know? And so, in terms of like my life back then, a lot of the performances that we did always involved being naked and covering your body with stuff.
Yeah, a lot of that. Yeah. And you had some t-shirts that were almost unwearable that said cock is cool.
So you know who's in that t-shirt is Alton Delaney naked.
Right.
Poor Alton.
You don't see anything.
Devastating. Like he does not want that. He probably bought all of them and burned them.
Well, I tried to wear mine like around. You couldn't. It was just you couldn't wear it. In the 90s. I mean, now I could pull it off. Yeah. But then
I remember
it
you
was,
say that about the t-shirt. It's a cool t-shirt, but it's really hard to wear.
Oh, people stare you down. Mm. They don't know what it means. It's so confusing to people.
Well, we had a few in a box at the start of this podcast in the early years. We found some in a box, and Faust was like, let's sell them. So we sold them for like $80.
No, $150 a piece.
Yes. So they were expensive. We got Jim Vararos, who was on season one of American Idol, to model one. And I think he's supposed to be coming back in the studio.
He's
soon.
Scheduled to come back on the show. One of the first openly gay reality TV stars. Yeah. The first openly gay American Idol contestant.
Do you still have a Cock is Cool t-shirt?
I do not have. They all got sold.
They all got sold?
Oh my God.
I do. I have one, but I'm not supposed to say.
Oh. Okay.
No, but so Alton, who's the world's most famous gift wrapping artist, he was like, I don't like the way we organize this. He's famous, you know, and he's naked, covered in yellow paint.
I love it.
And so
go ahead.
No. So the way that was put together is we had some friends who are strippers, bodybuilders, who had these beautiful photos taken of them. And back then, you know, the atmosphere that was there in Austin, Texas in the early 90s, this really is a great story to illustrate that. I was like, well, what was the name of the photographer? He's like, oh, that's Katie. She would love you. She would love to take pictures of you. Here's her number. So I call her and I'm like, Katie, can we do a photo shoot? And I was like, sure. So I brought all my drag, took a bunch of photos with her. And she's like, let's do some more. Can you get your friends? And of course, sure. So it was Brian Greene, Alton Delaney, and some other guys that I had hooked up with.
It wasn't multiple orgasm, Mike.
Multiple argument. That's a different story. Okay. No. So it was two other guys that I had gone on dates with from like, personal ads or I met at bars or something, you know? So it's a bunch of gay guys and a straight guy, Brian. And I just brought buckets of paint and clay and we painted ourselves in rainbow colors, took those photos. And then we covered ourselves in mud and the mud took the colors of the rainbow. and then took more photos of us. And we were like lying down, and the photography was stunning and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the photographer was so mortified that people would know her name that she wanted me to credit her as Kate X, like Malcolm X.
That's so funny.
Not to be confused with Kate X Messer, our friend in Austin, Texas. This is a different person.
That's so funny.
And you know, there was just this atmosphere that if you can dream it, you can do it. And everybody was in each other's bands. Everybody was like a backup singer, a musician, doing, there was just a lot of free time because rent was cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us didn't have jobs
or minimal jobs.
And yeah. Like the only person that really had a full-time job that we knew was you.
I mean, yeah. When I was in school, when I think about this, I'm kind of in shock. It was possible to go to school full-time, work in a restaurant on Friday and Saturday nights, and support myself completely.
Yep. That's all changed.
And I didn't have school loans or anything. I mean, I had Pell Grants. That's all changed. So what that does to young people, I mean, the bitterness, I totally understand the bitterness that is felt towards us, because here we are in our 50s and we kind of escaped by the skin of our teeth, able to buy property. I mean, I bought this house in Austin for $27,000 in 1995. My mom gave me $5,000 to do it.
Wow.
Can you imagine? Like, it's out of reach. And the fact that there aren't cheap artistic communities, I mean, it does worry me.
I'm following a post on social media about the cost of rent and the cost of housing in Austin, and just people are just like, where do we go? What do we do as we get priced out of this place? And the people are like, Eureka Springs, do I go to Pittsburgh? Do I go to Detroit? Where do I go?
Well, what about people who don't have the mobility? Like their trailer home park that they've lived in for 20 years closed down.
Yeah.
Like, I worry. This place is. But on a different note, the other aspect of Austin in that time was that, thanks to the father of cable access, George Stoney, the filmmaker, cable access was a thing. And if you wanted a cable franchise in a town, the town could require you to provide funding for a cable access studio. And that was fun as all get out for us. You had a popular show.
Let me tell this story here. I went to New York City for 1993, March on, it was like a pride parade or something, some event in New York City, and the March on Washington in 1993. And the word on the street was like, all the drag queens have cable access shows in New York City.
They did, yeah.
And I was like, cable access? What is that? Like, they're like, basically, they'll pay for you to be on television. I was like, okay, I want that. And so I got back and I called you, Miss Television, and I was like, how do I get myself on TV? I want to be on TV. You're like, call the cable Austin Cable Access and see what they got, you know? And they're like, well, we have, for half an hour, you can, if you're part of a community, you can do community outreach and called Open Studio. And you're going there to talk about issues that you're relevant to your community, that you're passionate about. So I was like,
that was the beauty of the place. They didn't really police it very heavily at all.
I dressed up as Cristina Sagarelli, the Cuban Oprah. So as Faustina with the blonde wig, and showed up with posters on how to put on makeup, how to make a vegan Caesar salad, and just ranted for half an hour, just like this podcast.
Yeah.
With this high voice, buenas tardes, this is Faustina, and you are watching, naturally, El Show de Faustina. You know, doing my West Side Story, Rita Moreno accent, which actually is, both Rita Moreno and I base our accents on our parents, on our fathers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, she does her mom.
She does her mom? Okay. And mine, yeah. Mine's my dad. You know, you bet. My father will always be like, no matter what time of the year it is, you better behave. You better be good. Santa Claus is coming to town. I was like, shut up, Dad.
So meanwhile, yeah. So Mark, what are you doing in the 90s?
Well, I too am reading Angry Women. That was a book that was passed around everywhere. Yeah. All of my alternative friends. So in the late 80s, I would have still been in college, and early 90s, still in college. I'm just kind of figuring out my life. So where I grew up in Erie is it was a post-industrial town, but it did have a pretty good art scene, you know. So there was a lot of, you know, improv, comedy, acting. And so all my friends were in that world. So it was a lot of grunge bands, punk rock bands, going out to clubs, going out to seeing shows. Because I'm of that age where it's like we're right behind the boomers. So when I was 17, 18, 19, still trying to get, you know, my sisters would take me out to the clubs. And I mean, some of these places, it was like, even though it's Erie, PA, it was like Studio 54. I mean, it was cocaine on the tables. It was people dancing and partying till dawn, and the clubs would be filled. And as I slowly got older, they kind of aged out of the scene. And now I go back home to Erie and it's just like, it's just not the same anymore. People just don't go out like they used to.
What do you say about Lindsay Lohan?
Oh, well, I used to joke. It was a joke that I heard from an old lady who said, like, oh, I've spilled more than she drank. And so, you know, it was a lot of partying and a lot of fun. And then eventually I was just kind of like, OK, I need to kind of move on with my life. So I picked up my stuff and I moved to Europe for about a year and a half and then stayed there in the Bavarian Alps. And I thought I would
and
be going.
And didn't you work in some like big hotel or something?
I worked in a hotel for the Armed Forces Recreational Center, which is run by the GIs. And so, you know, I was backpacking through Europe and I met a couple and they were just like, this is where we're working. They give you housing and they pay you in American dollars. And they said they loved it. And so I went and I applied and I got a job there. And I worked, and we lived in an old Nazi hospital that had been converted into a hotel, and that became our residence. And so, you know,
did you ever see any ghosts?
I didn't see any ghosts, but it was a huge place, and there was a lot of homoerotic Nazi art. Like,
really?
Yeah, they.
My favorite kind.
I know, right?
There was this one giant mural on the wall, and it was all these Aryan guys. Riding on horses or in a field. It had kind of a very, you know, it was painted during the 30s, right? So it kind of had almost like that WPA kind of look to it in some senses. Mm-hmm. But they were all blonde haired, blue eyed, and they were completely naked. But the Americans, when they took over, put loincloths on all of them. And
really?
Yeah. And some of the other stuff that they'd have, and they'd have like these, I'll try and find some pictures of it and I'll send it to you. And there was like carved little swastikas into some of the woodwork here and there. And then the craziest thing though was like they have these huge bathtubs that you could I who am almost 6 feet tall, I could lay down in this bathtub.
Oh, so,
like because it was, you know, it was a hospital, right? And so I think that they had to like, well, you know, wash people and do things. And they had like subterranean basements that were storage rooms, and I used to bring girls down there and. Because I had a roommate.
So were you having sex with girls then?
I was, yeah. It was also, too, you know, part of the thing is, like, you know, I worked for the armed forces. And so don't ask, don't tell was not even a thing yet. So, like, if you were caught doing anything, you could just get fired. And so I was just like, and I wasn't really quite sure yet. You know what I mean? So
had you had sex with any guys at that point?
I had.
Okay. Illicit, torrid affairs,
short-lived,
like truck stops, or what? Like, what is?
One of the first times was when I was traveling around and I met a guy at a nude beach in Italy, and so he took me out into the bushes, and that was fun. And then I went back the next day, and he came and he took me to his apartment in La Spezia, which was nearby. So we hopped on a train, we messed around on the train, which was really hot. And then we went back to his apartment, and it was like it was his summer apartment or something because he lived in Genoa. We messed around there, and then we went out for pizza afterwards. And La Spezia is where the Italian Marines are stationed. And
so holy cow. Oh my God. Hot. This is the sexiest. There's so many people are masturbating right now.
I am.
Well, the place where he took me, like in the bushes, was the road there is called the Via dell'Amore, you know, so the road of love.
Oh my God. Yeah, oh so my God.
If you ever get a chance to check out Cinque Terre in Italy, it's a beautiful space.
What did he say about your butt?
No, that's another person.
That's another guy?
That was another guy.
Tú tienes un botito.
But you know, the thing about him was like, I was still closeted and I was so afraid. I told him my name was John and I was from Cleveland.
Oh, God. John from Cleveland.
And he didn't speak any English. So I just spoke to him in Spanish and he spoke to me in Italian.
Wow.
Because like Italians can kind of understand Spanish, you know, it's not hard for them because it's a romance language.
So in your mind, as you're like, on the train, traveling back to wherever you're going, mm-hmm. like you've just had this incredible sexual experience. Like, when you say you weren't certain, like what's happening in your mind? Are you like, maybe I'm bi?
I think it's more of that kind of thing. Something, yeah. You know what I mean? Cause I remember it. I was very influenced by this book when I was like, in sixth grade, I found this book in my house and it was called 101 Men's Fantasies. Right. And there were 101 stories, erotic stories, and had different chapters and stuff. So it was like, I read this religiously. I hid the book. I don't know where it came from. Eventually it just kind of disappeared. I don't know if somebody found it and threw it out, but it had some worn tears, like the pages were very worn. but you know, it had this idea that like you can have a fantasy about being with a man without being gay. And Faust and I both, you know, I came of an age, you know, I was a freshman in high school. I started feeling like, you know, I knew that I had these desires or whatever. But then AIDS hit the scene. And so it seemed to me in my mind, it was just like, if you become gay, you're just going to die. So in my way, it was kind of an avoidance of a kind of thing. And so I just thought to myself, well, if I just don't have gay sex, gay, and then I won't die. And so there was a lot of fear driven. And of course, you know, it's people are dying left and right. And it's scary as hell.
That was something that I think maybe younger people don't fully grasp when they are angry at us for not doing enough. It felt like our generation, you know, to see your friends be sick and to personally be afraid. I mean, I was mostly having sex with straight guys, but I was really afraid. Mm-hmm. And you guys were really afraid. I mean, the atmosphere of fear that descended over just wanting to have a one-night stand, you know, like it really altered our sense of freedom and autonomy and power in a way that's maybe hard to comprehend now. Like, we did fight the power, but there was a certain sort of limiter on us because we were really struggling just to have free sex lives.
Also, too, you know, I had gone to an all-boys prep school my first year in freshman in high school, and I was targeted. You know, I was stalked by a priest.
You were? Right?
I was stalked by a priest. Now, thankfully, I was able to, you know, rebuke him and stuff, but other students noticed, you know. They noticed him coming up to me in class and trying to give me massages.
Gross!
It was gross, and at the time, I didn't really piece it together of what was happening. And so, but you know, then I was bullied because of it, and eventually I changed schools, and it wasn't until later.
So the other kids are bullying you because you're getting special attention, or they're saying you're queer.
Well, they're saying I'm queer, right? Because they can see that I'm not comfortable with this whole situation, you know. And so, and I think part of it too is like those kids. Now that I look back on it, were probably maybe attracted to me as well, and they didn't know how to deal with it. Right?
Because you were just so unbelievably sexy.
Well, you know, it was Catholic school, you know, and back then it was like we knew this priest was predatory. And you had this feeling as though you couldn't do anything about it, right? And that you were just like, if that's what they wanted, that's what you had to give in. And that's why I just kind of like, I had to leave that school, and I didn't really explain exactly what was happening, because I was, you know, I was 15 years old. I didn't have the words to explain it. I didn't understand it really until years later, exactly how it all kind of really played out.
And that's when I, part so, of the,
and so when, ahead, I, sorry. When I talk, when, you know, when you hear people talk about rape culture, especially women talk about rape culture, you know, people dismiss it. I know it's real, and I know that it's out there, and I know that there are systematic oppression of people who are like, will force you into having sex with you, whether you want to or not.
You know? And that the secrecy that surrounded gayness at that, you were really damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Right.
If you were a young man, I mean, I don't know a single gay man my age who didn't have older man predatory advances. And you're so thirsty as a young person for experience and for love, honestly, that we would, and as a young woman, you know, older men do it to young women too, but young people in general, you're so thirsty for experience that you cooperate with these predators. And then you're sort of wrecked and devastated and left with the shame and guilt and recrimination. And there's no space to talk about it.
Right.
And you are the one in the wrong. It never occurs to you at that age, I think, that the adult is doing something wrong. It's something I did to attract it. And it really gets into your mindset, even as an adult, even as an adult.
And so the Diocese of Pittsburgh issued a list of, they did a report on the priests and who did things like this. And so that inspired the Diocese of Erie, where I grew up, to do the same kind of thing. And when the list came out, my sister sent it to me, and it's like, I didn't have to look. Like, he was the first name. This priest was the first name on the list. Of course, it was done in alphabetical order, and his name started with an A, but it was just like, I didn't have to read any further. It's like, there was his name, and I had seen that he was moved to that school after he had molested some boy at a summer camp, and the boy ran away. And it's like, I ran away too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's that same kind of situation where this was allowed to repeat. And, you know, it was in some way, it was devastating for years, because it was just like, it was so much shame. I had to leave schools. Thank God I had good friends, because they all, you know, they say that, like, as long as you have like one adult in your life who believes in you or supports you or something, or friends, that you can make it. You know, had I not had that support network of childhood friends and adults who cared and loved for me.
Who were those people?
Well, I had, like, my sister Margot was one, but also my friend, my good friend Daria, and her mother was a good friend of me. Yeah, Joan, who was named after Joan Crawford, because her mother looked like Joan Crawford.
Oh, Joan. So you were able to tell her what was happening?
I don't think I was able to really vocalize exactly what happened.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always matter.
Yes,
as long as you feel the support, you know?
Yes.
And so I felt the support, and I did feel the love. And, you know, I switched schools, and I had new friends almost instantaneously. Because, like, you know, when you're the new kid in school, you're almost like a celebrity, right? Because everybody's like, who is this person? Oh, he's the new guy. So I had very good friends who are still my best friends to this day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Wow. What an odyssey. It's kind of crazy. Yeah. So when you guys met, how did you guys meet again? You met at a show?
I went up to Mark at a bar and said, haven't we been chatting on the internet? And Mark's like, internet?
We were at the Chicago Eagle, which was a very famous gay bar here in town, a leather bar. And I'm sitting at the back bar, not in the back room where guys get the blowjob. Well, you could probably get a blowjob back there, too.
There was a bar that served beer in the back.
Yeah,
and you could look at people going in and out of the back room. Mm-hmm. And so you'd kind of hang out there to see if somebody that you were attracted to, you know, and would go in there.
And so Fouser comes up to me, and he's just like, do I know you from the internet? And I'm just like, what? And he's like, no, I haven't, because I hadn't been chatting with anybody on the internet. I had chatted in previous years, but nothing ever came of it. You know, I was in school at the time. It wasn't really something I had done. This is way before Grindr and Scruff and all those kinds of things. And I never really did that many, like, you know, anonymous hookups. It was always just kind of you meet somebody at a bar. So we're sitting there talking, and he told me his name was Fausto, and I'm, of course, like, what kind of name is that? You know, that kind of thing. So when I hear people kind of say it to him today, I'm just kind of like, oh, that was me. But also, yeah. we had been drinking, and so he's just like, you look exactly like this guy. I have a photo of him at home. Do you want to come see it? And so I, you know,
I was just like, God.
I'll have to come see it. He lived right around the corner. And so he was cute. He had little glasses and he had a buzz cut. It was dark. So I'm just like, all right, sure. So let's go. Let's go out. Dark. And so then we go out on the street and he's under the street lights. And I see that his buzz cut is Buzz, but it's also rainbow colored Jaguar print. That was done by JoJo, who is a a local artist here in town.
He was Dennis Rodman's hairstylist, yeah. who came up with that look, the multicolored look.
So then we go back to his apartment, and it's filled with like tinfoil hats.
Which apartment?
On Winnemac and Clark Street. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's literally like less than a quarter of a mile. It was around the block.
Yeah.
And so I go back, and he's got like pictures of himself in drag. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I get into?
In for penny, in for pound.
And so we had sex.
I don't know if we said this.
What?
It, or maybe your audience is so familiar. Like, you, Fausto, your drag, I don't know why, but you often, one of my favorite performances of yours in the performance art church was a full drag dress in made out of tinfoil with this kind of cone tinfoil headpiece.
That was sitting there on one of the shelves.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that was all inspired by Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, you know? So a lot of our drag was sort of John Wan, you know, you monkey see, monkey do, right? So our drag was about shocking and being a rebel, of having fun, humor, thrift stores, you know, whatever you could put together. It was, you know, what we call today booger drag.
I mean, it wasn't, we weren't going for dirtness. We were going for kind of a trash glam.
Yes. Yeah. And so Priscilla, Queen of the Desert comes out, and a lot of the costumes in that movie are made from everyday household items.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, I don't know where it popped into my head, but I was like, you know, I bet aluminum foil, since it's very malleable. It's a great sculpture. And to this day, in 2021, no Rue Girl has ever stolen that look, which I'm really happy, because I was like, they've stolen so much other things, but it's like, and, you know, so it's like, it the best way to describe it is that you can coil aluminum foil into rope, basically, and you can use that rope to make shapes that look like wigs, and you can spray paint it to all these wonderful colors and make these outrageous costumes that also you can bust out of.
So we hook up.
Yeah, but the Fausto decided I do believe he asked me to marry him within 5 minutes. He says it took him a week.
And then, but we're laying in bed, you waited.
And I looked at him, and I looked around his room. I said, "Do you watch the TV show Earth Final Conflict?" And his eyes got really bright. And I don't know if you know this, the show, but it's about these gender nonconforming aliens. And he was just, I think that's when he really fell in love with me.
When did you fall in love with him? When did you know?
I think when he's asked that question.
No, when did, Mark, when did you know?
When did I know? I don't know. It's one of those things that just kind of creeps up on you, right?
He was roped into it.
Well, because Fausto, I mean, you and I are similar in that people either really, really love us or they really hate us. It's not in between.
Well, the thing about Fausto, too, is like he works hard and he's relentless. You know,
he's relentless.
He's relentless. Yes. So he was just kind of like, one of my favorite movies is the movie, the film Crossing Delancey. And the advice that the old woman gives to this guy is, if you want to win the love of my granddaughter, is like, you just have to be there. You have to be like a furniture in the room, you know? you got to show up.
Oil in your kitchen drawer.
You know? And Fausto just kind of like, we had hooked up. I went to his birthday party.
Well, you went to Europe.
And then I went to Europe for a month. And then you came back. I hadn't seen him. And then I just ran into him on the street. He had seen a terrible production of Romeo and Juliet. Yeah, with his friend. He's just like, hey, we're going to this party. Why don't you come? I'm like, all right. And I think maybe it was that night, maybe.
And we started holding hands. And my sister was like, hey, this guy is good. You should don't let him go, you know?
Yeah, Talia, his sister Talia really pushed him on me.
Well, yeah. That's one of, I remember, you know, we all adored you, Mark, as soon as we met you. And we're like, holy cow, how did Fausto
look I know, right?
Oh my God. How has he managed to land this wonderful man, as people say about me and Paul. So I say this with total love, but there was like a year you guys broke up. I remember coming to Chicago and being, it was really devastating just as your all's friend, but Fausto, I've never seen you like that. You were brokenhearted.
Yeah. 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 you know, Mark and I broke up. It was around the time Mark's father passed away.
He died in March. I think 9/11 happened in September. So there was, you know, I was grieving my dad. I graduated from, I got my MBA from Loyola. The economy was terrible before 9/11. And then after 9/11, it was even worse. So there was just a lot of figuring out that needed to be done and where to go. And I'll be honest with you, and Foster doesn't believe this, but you've seen that apartment. It was so cluttered and filled with so much garbage.
Oh,
it
my
caused
God.
Me a lot of anxiety.
It was intense. You know? It was intense.
Yeah, I just like clutter causes me anxiety and it's hard for me to live with.
Yeah.
You know, because it's always just like they're eating away at you. And that's,
you're how old at this point?
33.
Mm-hmm. And that's really the age where we are like, oh, I am an adult now. Like the 20s are over. Yeah. Now I really got to figure out what I'm doing here. Yeah. So it's an intense time.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Oh, what happened that brought you back?
Well, he stayed furniture in the room. He just, we became friends. And
you're making it sound like you're being chased.
Like Fausto, you kept calling him?
Well, no. Man's rejection is God's protection. And Mark was going through a lot. Mm-hmm. And I didn't talk to Mark for at least, you know, it felt like almost a year.
No.
And in terms of like, you know, getting back together with Mark, it was my 30th birthday. I invited him to be part of it. And Mark made a gift for me, which was an Eartha Kitt puppet.
Oh, my God.
That looked more like E.T. than Eartha Kitt.
Yeah, but the idea. Oh, my God.
And he's like, this will be good for the shows. And part of it is like Mark was also a very important part and a very vital part of organizing these musical variety shows called Feast of Fools. And so when we broke up,
did that continue?
That continued. Even we had split up. I was like, Mark, I really need your help with this. If you can help, that would be fantastic. And, you know, the plots of the show were also me trying to make sense of us being permanently separated. You know,
like what?
So we always had a boyfriend, but the boyfriend always died in the end.
So it was kind of like a very South Park where Kenny, they killed Kenny, you know? So the humor, it was a show within a show. So it was a scripted, skit like show that had also guest appearances, performance. So think about it like South Park with drag queens as characters, but in a Saturday Night Live format where there's other performances happening in between. And so the characters related to the guest performances. Mm-hmm. And so the punchline is always like, oh, nuts, you know, at the end, I can't keep a man because he keeps dying. You know, one would get electrocuted. The other one would get eaten by zombies. The other one would get,
turn into a monster.
Turn into a monster and be put in a medical exhibit. You know, like there was always this ridiculous mechanism that kept the main character from having a satisfying relationship.
Just like the reboot of Sex and the City.
Just because it becomes more interesting. You know, people don't want to, you know, in terms of like
a happy ending like that.
Well, theater is about struggle and drama. And, you know, you want to have your characters in peril. And so you introduce these characters to the audience and, you know, and immediately I was like, oh, my God, I have a new boyfriend this week. And they're like, what's going to happen? Is he going to die like the last one? It's like, no, this time it's totally different. He's a nurse. So if he dies, he'll know how to, keep himself from dying, So it was always like this ridiculous mechanism. And then, working together was kind of adversity for Mark and I, because, a lot of these, some of the individuals that are involved in the show were really bitter, toxic people.
They were challenging. And if people aren't in theater, they may not understand that we would pour our life and soul for weeks and weeks into these productions when, in Austin and you in Chicago, that were really elaborate and took a lot of time and focus. It's hard to comprehend now. And once the internet took over, I marvel, but it was so fun because it would be a big group of people trying to put something on, and then you'd have this big audience. It was really a community experience of weirdo art gay people. I mean, you guys created a super intense community in Chicago.
Well, and putting these shows on, it was weeks of work, almost $1,000 cost in production that we sometimes would recoup, sometimes we wouldn't.
And
one of the things that I was like trying to do is just, notify the audience that wanted to go see these shows that the next one was happening. So we would do about 4 a year. And I started blogging, I created an email list, and I teamed up with my friend Mindy, who was involved in cable access production, Mindy Hilt, who now works, she's in television too. She's done a lot of those daytime talk shows. She's a producer for them. Uh-huh. And she and I put together these testimonial videos based on Apple's Switch ads. Mm-hmm. And Mark's in them as well. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to sort of like just using the internet as a way to drive the audience to these shows, because you had to spend so much money just reminding
mailing people postcards that the show is coming.
Oh my God. Right. Putting up posters and flyers.
And so, the podcast naturally arose from that blog. That was Feast of Fun. It was something that was meant to consolidate attention and consolidate that audience so that audience wouldn't dissipate. And so when we were had first heard about podcasting, we really genuinely thought that we were late to the game. This was not something that we were on
the cutting edge, because they had started in earlier 2004. And by December, Faust was like, I'm so late to the game. I'm like, Faust, we're not
too
late. We can start one after Christmas.
So we started February 8th, 2005. Mm-hmm. And it was Mark, me and the musical director, Taylor E. Ross, talking about the Super Bowl halftime show.
And the ads.
And the ads.
Oh,
and,
God.
And that sort of like pop culture moment, because the year before that was Breastgate with Janet Jackson.
Right.
And that was a very important cultural moment, because it drove everybody to saying, you know what? I'm going to give up on my dreams to be on television, because television is never going to have space for someone like me. Mm. And so we turned to the internet, because we were like, this is the only way we can develop and grow our artistic careers.
Mm-hmm. You kind of got to walk through the door that opens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never expected to be so happy working on an MTV show, but
that is so wild.
When the door opens, it's like, oh, okay. So having really preconceived notions about what you're going to do, you got to remember that's the thing that gets you to the next thing. But when the next thing comes, just because it isn't what you imagined, don't refuse it. Like, stay open, stay receptive. Because we don't know. We don't know what impact we're going to have. It's all, flexible. But one of the things that I think you have had, you guys and the show has had a big impact on culture, it's not often acknowledged, but I do, Fausto, want to ask you about something that I think is interesting psychologically about you. And Mark, I'm interested in your opinion. So I often hear you say that people steal ideas from you or have taken things or have been influenced by you guys and they don't give credit. Talk to me about when the first time was that you felt that way.
Oh, God. The issue that I have with that is not that someone is plagiarizing or copying or stealing our ideas, because we put these ideas out there in order to inspire other people. The issue I have with it is that people feel like they stole something and then don't want to have any kind of relationship with us. They don't want to return to the scene of the crime.
The important thing to keep in mind is that we're all connected and it's natural to want to imitate what you love.
That's the piece that we've got to stay in touch with, is that we're in synchronicity.
Yes.
And there is not groupthink in the sense of we're all thinking the same thing, but the same ideas are in this big soup that we're all part of. And unconsciously, we are aware of these things happening. And I would offer that moving on your impulse, because like you guys are going to have an abundance of ideas.
We're
stop having your idea generators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have been mad at myself for the last 3 years because I had an idea to make a documentary about the New South, because my mother lives a block from the Lee Monument in Richmond, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I'm like there, and she's a neighborhood activist. So I'm like, I can get introduced to all the Monument Avenue people who want to save the monuments. I can, you know, talk to the Black Lives Matter protester. I'm like, this would be an amazing film. I can see the film in my head. I hope it gets made. Mm-hmm. But I didn't make that film because you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. And maybe in my parallel existence, that is happening. And so I've been reading about parallel universes, and I would just offer that maybe some of these things you are doing in other dimensions, and you don't have to worry about it so much.
And I think also, too, I think every now and then things kind of get pop up in pop culture that get referenced to the show. And incidentally, you know, in the new West Side Story, which is phenomenal, if you get a chance, if you like the musical, go see it.
It's great.
Go see it. For whatever reason, there's just one little shout out to Signora Fausta. And as Fausta is like probably, you know, other than Ricky Martin, he's probably one of the most out gay Puerto Ricans.
Bad Bunny, Ricky Martin, and me.
Yeah.
And Walter Mercado is no longer with us.
And so,
so the list is small.
So I wonder if
Larry LaFontaine, too.
Maybe if whoever, Tony Kushner, maybe if he's listening to the podcast or something like that. I don't know if he.
Well, that's the thing about it is,
because she's not in the original film.
I mean, we've had these actual experiences where people come up to us and they're like, I don't want to tell you, but I've been a huge fan of your podcast for years. And you're like, well, thanks for coming out of the closet and telling, you know, I mean, these are people with influence and money and access to power confiding in us that they have been benefited from the idea factory, because Feast of Fun is a think tank.
Mm-hmm. And we will never stop running out of ideas.
And you know, one, and sometimes it's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. We had a drag queen, Sally, on the show. We're talking about RuPaul's Drag Race. There was a reality TV show called Angels of the Runway, Models of the Runway, that had the models from Project Runway sort of undressing and talking about the show.
Yeah.
And Sally said, why don't they do that with Drag Race and call it Untucked? And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And it's a great idea, and it's a wonderful show. And that's ambiguous. Specific, pixel per pixel, the lesbian pride flag is mopped, swiped, stolen from the lipstick lesbian pride flag that we designed, because we came up with it as an idea from a show about cougar pride. Mm-hmm. So Time Magazine had an article about women reclaiming their sexuality and, you know, lipstick lesbians and all this sort of like hyper feminine, hypersexual identity for women over the age of 40. And I was like, well, if bears can have a pride flag, why can't lipstick lesbians and cougars have one? You know, and so I took shades of lipsticks, warm shades and cooler shades, and put a white stripe in the middle, just like the bear pride flag. And instead of a bear paw print, it was a set of lips. So, you know, this is like the end of Working Girl, where Melanie Griffith turns to Sigourney Weaver and says, how did you come up with the idea? You know, so this this blogger who's, you know, racist, she's transphobic. She's
a TERF, right?
She's a terrible person. She appropriates this and moves the middle stripe up, but makes the fatal mistake of not changing the lips. And so you can digitally superimpose her flag with ours, so you can see that she actually did steal those lips.
She took the white stripe from the bottom and she put it in the middle because she needed to center whiteness.
Yeah.
is my joke.
This inspired this, for whatever reason, this symbol means a lot to a lot of women in the world. And then another blogger in Australia trying to move away from that transphobic person's claim. She simplified it into what I call it the Dunkin' Donuts lesbian pride flag.
She got rid of the lips.
She got rid of the lips. And so it's one.
Because not all lesbians have lips.
A white stripe in the middle, you know, with a warm red and a gold in the top, and then pink and purple on the bottom. That's when culture can be really exciting and cool, is that it's this like cosmic game of telephone where we react and continue this game of love, this game of culture and storytelling, and our shared experiences live on beyond us. There's a saying that goes, if you're doing it right, no one will ever know you've done anything at all. And that is so true for our experience. You know, some people are always crediting us, you know, our past guests say, you know, we inspired them to do a podcast. They wouldn't be podcasting if it wasn't for us. And then there's other guests who are mortally afraid of mentioning our name. There was an article that ran in one of those tabloid presses about all these scandals with drag race girls. And they put links to the audio.
Hot link, which is,
you know, it's theft and it's not a good practice. And it costs us money to basically host the content for a tabloid blog. And, you know, I wrote to them and I said, please, you know, host the file locally or don't link back to us. They will not mention our name ever. And to me, it's frustrating because, you know, part of it is like, you know, you're being blacklisted, you know, you're being shadow banned by these rich, powerful corporations, and you have evidence about that. And to me, that I think that's unfair. I think it's rude, but it's also the world we live in. And I can either, you know, be bitter and sad about it, or I can, you know, try to find some kind of solution and focus on the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who celebrate what we do, who are willing to come on the show, who love us unconditionally as we love them unconditionally. And, you know, I imagine that our audience and other people out there have the same experience that we do and are equally frustrated and equally angry. And, you know, if anything I can say to them is like, understand that we're on your side and we will acknowledge you and we will celebrate you. Together, we can overcome anything.
So here's what I offer. Let's all do a ritual right now.
Yes.
I'll get naked.
Everybody who's listening right now, Fausto and Mark, get a glass and fill it with water.
Okay. I have one that's half filled. Is that okay?
It's fine.
Okay.
Just a glass of water.
All right.
And in this glass of water, I'm making this up as I go. In this glass of water are all the stories. Like, you just told me a bunch of stories. Those stories. So I know those stories do not serve your abundance and your reach. So don't ever tell any of those stories again. And when you catch yourself, and I'm saying this to you, I'm saying this to myself, I'm saying this to everyone who listens. When you catch yourself telling a story about how the world screws you over, pause, take a drink of water, everyone. And remember that there's always water and there's always air. Do not focus on those stories anymore. Literally, everyone turn to another direction, right or left, doesn't matter. Look behind you and visualize what you want to move towards, what you want momentum towards. Take another drink of water. And this is how we put those old stories to rest. Stop telling them.
That's very powerful.
I'll think about it.
Give the people the air. Give the people the air. Give the people the water. That's part of it is like, you know, and not to undo the healing magic of your prayer and your ritual. It's part of it is like there's value in telling that story, but it's important to tell that story in the right place and under the right context.
I'm not sure.
For somebody you trust, you know, or and part of it is like, you know, like any kind of ongoing trauma or struggle. And there's plenty of podcasts out there that all they do is talk about struggle. There's podcasts called La Brega, which is in Spanish for the struggle, you know, literally talking about people's struggle in life. And Feast of Fun is asset-based celebration of life and culture.
Yes.
And if anything has served us more than is naming that show Feast of Fun is a reminder, you know, it's not just about catching flies with honey than with vinegar. It's about that, you know, the way you approach problems profoundly shapes the outcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at the same time, I also learned from Kate Bornstein, trans activist, writer, playwright, forgive yourself and forgive them. You know, because you're going to make mistakes. They're making mistakes and we're imperfect. Only RuPaul is perfect. And she's not perfect. You know, and the most important thing we can do is focus on the love that we share with each other. You know,
well, like, the metaphor I'll use, which is happening outside my window right now, is that when I got here yesterday, all the bird feeders were empty. This morning, like 45 minutes ago, maybe, I filled all the bird feeders. And sure, there's three squirrels on the bird feeders. There's one sitting there right now, just raiding it. Now, should I focus on the three squirrels? Or should I notice that there's hummingbirds, there's cardinals, there's all these other birds flying around suddenly in the yard. And what do I care if the squirrel's eating there too? I'm going to focus on the birds.
You don't like squirrels?
That is the key. Squirrels are fine, but I'm not really feeding them. I want the birds. That's what I want. But I'm not going to resist the squirrels. Do you see the difference that I'm trying to draw attention to? So like,
well, squirrels are rascals, squirrels are, you know, there. Loki is a force, right? Loki is the trickster. And it's one thing to be the trickster, it's the other one to be trickstered.
But I'm not being trickstered. I'm getting what I want, which is that the birds are all around. So it's a focus issue. What will I focus on in this life? I'm going to focus on the fact that I can take a drink of water and see the birds.
Well, and the best way to overcome the Loki forces in the universe is to not give them power. You know, Loki exists or the coyote or the supernatural trickster beings exist to teach us a lesson.
And we live in a chaotic world.
Yeah, we live in a chaotic world, but also that, you know, they only get their power, their supernatural powers, by us believing in them or giving attention to them.
Yes.
You know, so like Voldemort, you saying his name, or Beetlejuice, you know, this idea that by drawing attention to this harmful supernatural or mindset or whatever it is, that makes it manifest itself stronger in your life.
Yes.
You know,
attention, positive or negative, that you give to something. That's why in politics, rather than screaming about what's wrong, it's best to pivot and move towards the thing you want to see. Like, sure, these things are going on, but what I'm concerned about is that children are incarcerated. So what do I want to see? I want children to not be incarcerated at the border. So the positive move is to engage with the system and shift it towards the thing I want.
Yeah, it's asset-based tricky. Activism.
Yeah.
It's focus tricky. On the positive, right?
Well, there's also a side of toxic positivity.
I know people are going to be mad and spiritual bypassing, but it is actually a rule of the universe that the thing we attract what we are. And so if we are manifesting what we don't like, we have to look at ourselves. Number one, what am I doing? And this probably is the hardest lesson. And it sounds like victim blaming, and that's not what I mean. There, at the soul level, we're trying to move through these obstacles so that we understand things more clearly.
It's also like a bit of a control issue, right? It's like these are things that you cannot control. Once you say something on the podcast, once you put something out there, it just becomes part of the world. And sometimes, you know, you give advice to people and they take it and they do really well with it, and maybe they give you credit for it, and maybe they don't. And
maybe they don't.
And sometimes you just have to let some people have those things. You know, I have so much. I've got Fausto. I've got a family that loves me. I have friends who loves me. I have a dog. You know what I mean? I have a lot. And so
You got a job, a credit card, a car.
So what if they have this thing? You know what I mean? I will have more things. Like you said, there'll be air. There'll be more water.
Well, toxic positivity involves dismissing negative emotions and responding to distress with false assurances rather than empathy. And that's definitely not what we're talking about here.
Yeah. We're not talking about that because the negative emotion is your first indicator that you want something to shift. It's a very helpful information. So it's actually very important to pay attention to when we have negative emotions. Like, I'm so angry right now. Well, what is that about?
Oh, so you want that shift. So you're like, what's going to make this different?
Yeah, it's the spark that gets you to go, well, I hate having this junky car that never runs well for me. I'm turning. It's like, oh, I could have a good car. I'm going to start thinking about the good car I'm going to have. And I know it sounds like idiot town, but it truly does work this way, that we can start thinking about the thing and it starts coming in. All the cooperative elements of the universe will start working with us, even at the cellular level in our bodies.
Well, it's also becoming comfortable with sadness, with negative emotions. You know, one thing that I'm trying to do more at work and in my life is instead of saying this person is transphobic or homophobic or harmful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because Mark and I don't use the word problematic. We use the word harmful consciously. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've started doing is describing the behavior in specific language and offering a solution, even when I don't see myself as the cause of the problem. So to me, it's like, you know, and I've just discovered this is like a homophobic person is somebody who identifies a problem, or a racist person identifies a problem and says someone else is the cause of the problem and doesn't offer any solutions, is not willing to examine why that problem exists, and says that the only solution to the problem, if they're pressured to, is extraditing that person from the circle. And so, for example, like white supremacist says, you know, the reason we have poverty in America is because there's too many immigrants here. Or a homophobic person says, you know, this gay person is ruining this party, this workplace, this team. And by removing that gay person, removing those people of color, then they feel like that's going to solve the issue. And that behavior, that mindset, we all have the ability to think that way, you know? So the most important thing that I can do is when I see a problem is one, acknowledge that I may be a part of that problem, and two, always offer the parties involved a way out, a solution. So then we can start having a healthier conversation about actually overcoming that obstacle.
Do you have any real world examples of that?
I can, but I can't talk about that.
You can't talk about it on the podcast.
Because it would get me in trouble.
I love those stories. Okay, I love those stories. Yeah.
You know, so,
well,
so
that is the place we're trying to move into is reconciliation. How do we bring those that have harmed us? How do we bring the pedophile priest? Here's a tough one. Back into the circle of humanity. That was a human, because, you know, as a therapist said recently at a conference I was at, she said she was trying to address sexual abuse in the community. And she said 7-12% of therapists self-report having sex with clients. A horrifying number, right? But she was like, look, so this is going to, and this is because I'm making a film about psychedelic psychotherapy. She's like, this is going to be here too. So let's pay attention to how our own trauma responses are being activated and creating walls of silence and just kind of freezing in the face of this authority figure creating harm. And she said, if you look statistically, every person who harms a client or like is a pedophile, they were all harmed as children. You know, they were, it's like we're just perpetuating. So how do we bring them back into the circle of humanity? Because just shutting them out isn't working because we keep perpetuating it. So I think
you're
exactly right.
And it doesn't stop the trauma from happening.
No, we have to get to the place. It's restorative justice. I mean, smarter people than me have been talking about this for a long time, but we're really in that moment. How do we create systems of restorative justice? That's going to be the trick of the next 100 years in terms of how we create our
culture. I think that it starts with being more invested in solutions than punishing.
Yes.
You know, and I've noticed this with regressive people, regardless of their Democrat or Republican or whatever political affiliation, they share these kind of three things in common. They're really angry when someone else has the same things they do. Mm-hmm. So like my...
That's the hate participation trophy.
They hate participation trophies. Like, and even though the Olympics gives out participation trophies and the whole concept of participation trophies come from the Olympics. They hate that concept. They feel so comfortable telling other people what to do. They're always seeking management or leadership positions because they're terrified of being subservient to somebody else. And, you know, and in the sense they're focused on punishment, you know, as a solution to problems. So their idea is that if I punish enough people, then they will stop that behavior that I don't like.
It doesn't work.
And it doesn't work.
It doesn't.
You know, regardless of what problem you think it is, punishment is never going to be. It's not even a deterrent against murder. You know, the death penalty, people ask me all the time, I was like, why are you not in favor of the death penalty? I'm like, because it doesn't accomplish anything.
No, it doesn't.
You know?
It just creates systemic violence. Like, it's rooted. We see it. Murder is part of our system.
Yeah. And, you know, wrapping this up, Kirthy, I just want to say...
You don't want to stop here?
Well, I just want to say, you know, you're beyond family to me and Mark. You know, you're a person who married us. You're
in the rain.
In the rain, in a little.
I did that because your mom was upset that you weren't going to have a ceremony. I couldn't stand that.
She was furious.
Well, we had a ceremony. It was just private. You know, she says, going to get married, and she's like, don't get married. I'm going to go to France. And we're just like, all right, well, we'll get married next year. And so we're like, then we looked at our taxes, and we're like, if we get married, then, then we'll
save
money.
Does it really save you a lot?
And so, yeah, it saved us thousands and thousands of dollars. And
really?
So And so then,
gays not being able to be married literally is theft.
Yeah.
Well, because you know, I ambushed Paul after 21 years this year and proposed to him in front of my nieces so he couldn't say no. Mm-hmm. And he actually said to me this morning, we've got to do the paperwork on it. But I wasn't sure if it actually saves money.
It depends on what your income level is, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. But there's also like, what if Fausto got sick? What if I got sick? That kind of thing. So we're like,
worries me.
We'll just get married and then we'll do it on the internet. Wow. Then she's just like, oh my God, you guys are going to get married without me. I'm like, well,
it's nice to have a parent that actually gets upset because they can't come to your same-sex wedding.
Because
there's my father, and you know, do you think your mother was upset that she couldn't go?
I don't think I barely even registered to my mother. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think she really put it. I think she kind of just put it out of her mind. Yeah.
And had my father been alive, my father loves parties.
Yeah.
He would have been upset about it, but he would want to have come, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Mark's father was kind of like, he would have been like, that's all right, as long as there's, you know, an open bar or something. Well, you know what I'm saying? Like, he was a much more chill kind of person.
Yeah. Well, and your mom, Fausto, is so dear to us because she really kind of mothered our little performance group at the very beginning. She kind of had a lovely sort of salon with a piano in her living room. And she loved to have us all come over and be kooky and put on shows for each other. I mean, she's really such a big part of why you are who you are.
She loved that group. She loved Peach. Mm-hmm. She loved it. She still talks about it to this day.
Yeah, she wanted you to do a documentary about it.
And then she found out how expensive it would be. And she's just like, what?
But, you know, this podcast is a testimonial to that, you know, deep relationship we had with each other and with all these artists, you know, Alton Delaney, Skip Shirey, to name a few, Sheila Grace Murthy. I mean, just so many great names that have come out from that collective. And, you know, and in a lot of ways, this podcast continues that and documents that, you know, and it's like, who knows? I mean, let me just give you a perspective here. This week, there's an app that came out that you type in the phrase of the work of art that you want to create, and it creates an abstract work of art using artificial intelligence.
Whoa.
Is that what you sent
me?
Yes. That's what that text were?
Yeah.
Foster sent me like abstract works of guys fucking in the gym.
So our wonderful audience.
I'm going to text you it too right now, Kirthy.
These wonderfully twisted, wonderful people got a hold of this. Like, you know, everybody starts sending me this shit. And and it's like, you know, they're like two guys fucking in a locker room. And the art is stunning.
Is it?
It really is unbelievable. And I'm like, what happens when machines create artwork that we love?
It's fine.
It's great.
It's part of it.
Yeah.
It's all part of it. I mean, I'm like you. Like, I am surprised that the weirdo performance artist that was in Peach in the 90s, a piece of that informs my work on Teen Mom because we break the fourth wall. So I have to be on camera and I have to and it's improvisation. We did a lot of, we had planned pieces, but there was an improvisational aspect and a love of the unusual and like what can't be planned. And that really informs who I am as a director of documentaries and Doc Follow TV, which I'm like, who? You couldn't create a school for us that would have led you to your podcast or led me to my TV work that could be more perfect. And that's the perfection of life, you know, all of it, which is why I think it's really important to enjoy ourselves as much as possible because we're on our paths. You just don't know what it's going to lead to necessarily, but we're on it.
Well, you know, and I think in terms of podcasting, the early podcasts were all scripted, you know, they were, the person would type out what they were going to say and they would read it. So it was a lot of ways of audio blogging.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Or like journalism.
Yeah. And then you and I came from this, you know, I would describe it, you know, the mindset was we had a Christmas tree and the ornaments were left to chance.
Yes.
We created a skeleton and we put in life, filled in the rest.
Yes.
And to this day, you know, how we do this podcast is how millions of people do their podcasts. And mm-hmm. and that's something that lives on beyond us. That will be not only that, but then artificial intelligence very soon will be combing this data, uh-huh. this conversation as mm-hmm. I'm having it right now, uh-huh. and generating new media, new works that will even outlive humanity itself.
Well, and when you think about how time consuming it is to edit audio, how great that technology will soon. I mean, you can transcribe this talk today mm-hmm. and you could potentially do a rough edit just based on text, and you wouldn't, that could be generated by the, you know, the technology, and you wouldn't have to painstakingly comb through. Like, it's all going to be, but what doesn't get changed is that the entertainment still has to be there, and entertainment is storytelling.
Well, it's how we hardwired. Yeah. We evolved from sitting around the campfire and sharing information and passing it from generation to generation to survive through storytelling.
To remember.
That's why we are here. Mm-hmm. Our relationship to the world, to dogs especially, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. all about that tribe, about those deep relationships and those deep stories that we realize, you know, if you fly too close to the sun, like Icarus, mm-hmm. you're going to get fucked. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that becomes a story that gets passed on generation to generation as a cautionary mm-hmm. tale, you know, the Twilight Zone, you know, Tyler Perry movies, Law and Order episodes, podcasts, they're all, you know, have this sort of biblical quality to them in the sense that we're learning life lessons by sharing these amazing stories. And the more amazing the story is, the more we learn from them. And mm. and that makes us better human beings. It makes us a better world. And it's how we love each other. You know, the Beatles say love is the only thing that matters. How does that song goes? I'm like blanking out. Love, 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 love.
All you need is love.
Love is all you need is love. And love is just the relationships that we have with each other.
Yeah.
And so if you can have a good, and this is the other thing too, I just want to leave people here with too, is like, there's this, you know, quality, not quantity, is more important than ever. The deeper the relationships mm-hmm. you have with the people mm-hmm. around you, your audience mm-hmm. on the internet, or mm-hmm. that's what's going to get you food in your refrigerator, heat mm-hmm. in your home, you know, fill your heart and fill your mm-hmm. bank account.
Mm-hmm.
Not mm-hmm. The size of those things, you know, that also helps too. But, you know, you can have it. I always said, it's like, Mark is always like, how the hell are these podcasts making six figures and they only have 100 listeners? I'm like, because those 100 listeners are all millionaires.
Yeah, right.
Or they're all people who are like, you know, deeply invested in the success of that person. And, you know, well, invest in your relationships.
Yes, have more fun. Yeah. When you're having more fun, follow your impulses.
Yes.
And it can flow fun. Easily.
Have fun.
How about a feast of fun?
Let's have some fun. That's the most unfun thing. Hey, fellow kids, would you like to have fun? Me and my skateboard and hat on the
right,
like that meme. Who's that actor with the eyes that pop out?
I forget.
Fellow kids meme.
Oh, I don't know.
If you just search, how do you do, fellow kids?
Oh, how do you do, fellow kids?
That's Steve Buscemi dressed up as a skateboarding teenager.
Oh, trying that's to nice.
Pass in high school.
Aww.
Let's have some fun.
I love you guys.
I love you too.
It's always fun to talk. And, you know, keep on doing it. We need you.
We will. 3001 podcasts, 3001 more to go.
All right.
And we will see you soon in Austin, right?
Yeah, in Austin. We'll see you in January. Aren't we going to cross over?
I think so, yeah.
We'll be there December 28th to the 10th.
We're going to cross over.
Awesome.
All right.
Thank you so much for being part of this incredible journey, Kirthy.
Oh, it's so fun. It's just fun to have fun with you guys and to see your progress and everything you've done. I'm so proud and inspired by you.
Thank you so much.
I'm so glad you're here with me.
Thank you. And was the first podcast you did with us, was that the 5-year anniversary of 9/11, or were you on before then? I'm trying to think.
I think it was they were known to the audience as the 9/11 lady.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Kirthy's like, I do other things.
It's
you know?
A very powerful podcast. Anybody who go back into the archives and listen to it, I'd still think about it.
The 9/11
really?
Lady.
Yeah, of course. Aww. Yeah.
Well, because you were talking about
you were an eyewitness
of being at Ground Zero on 9/11.
Yeah, it changed me forever.
Yeah.
Well, you were always this way. It just brought it to the surface.
Maybe so. It confirmed something. I didn't know that you could feel death happening, that it was an energetic wave, and it confirmed my sense of how energy works that has forever changed me, because I now believe it and have confidence in it, even though the materialist, scientific, mathematical world we live in doesn't give any credence to that. I know what I know.
Mm-hmm. You feel it.
You feel it.
I feel you, love.
Yeah. I feel the love. All right, guys. I love you.
Bye-bye, sweetie.
Love you.
Right. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
Kirthy Fix lives in Brooklyn some of the time in Austin, Texas. You can follow her on social media, Kirthy Fix, F-I-X.
And you can watch her on Teen Mom OG.
Teen Mom.
She pops up as one of the producers and talking to the people on the show.
Caitlin Baltierra.
Yeah.
She's not Latina, but it's an Italian name, I believe.
Oh, really?
Why? Yeah, we got on Teen Mom and we didn't have to get anybody knocked up.
Buster got his eyebrows done.
You know,
it's about time for you to get those eyebrows done again.
The weirdest thing about being on that one episode. So Kirthy and us, we were talking about sort of selling the idea of Mark and I being like the gay best friends to to Caitlin on Teen Mom. And well, so, you know,
you were just going to go get your eyebrows done.
And it was also like an excuse to get the eyebrows done. Because Caitlin's like learning how to be a makeup artist.
She's certified now.
Well, she wasn't before, too.
No, she was still she practiced on you. But you looked good. I mean, you looked a little Zeus-like.
I looked like Milhouse from The Simpsons.
The first day. But it wore in very well.
I thought it was one of the most fantastic things you could do for your face. Mm-hmm. And one of the easiest.
Because your eyebrows really do frame the face.
They do. Yeah. It's like wearing. Well, that's why drag queens who shave their eyebrows wear glasses.
Yeah.
So you can't notice they look like
freaks.
But what are those hairless moles that grow in the
hairless moles?
Yeah. So, you know, so we went there and we were taping the reality TV show. You know, Caitlin's with a needle and my eyebrow. And then Kirthy like comes over and is like, why don't you talk about putting up her children up for adoption? Placing the children up for. Why don't you talk about the abortion? And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Kirthy.
And she's poking us with a needle.
He was like, and so, you know, you sort of started having that conversation. It was a great conversation. Unfortunately, I don't think it ever made it onto the show, but we were enough in the show that, you know,
people recognized you.
We got new listeners and people follow us and obsess about us the way they obsess about the Kardashians. Ooh. So people are like, do you like the Kardashians too? And I'm like, I hate the Kardashians. And they're like, no. They're like, you know,
because I just don't really pay much attention to
the people who really, really love Teen Mom also watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Oh, I don't think that show's on the air anymore.
I don't. I wouldn't even know, you know, but, you know, that they have that sort of, that passion, that desire for watching documentaries, yeah. You know, and this year, man, there is Summer of Soul and the new, Peter Jackson documentary about the Beatles that's on Disney Plus. They're going to be neck and neck for best documentary film for 2021. And ironically, there's, you know, the COVID pandemic is keeping people out of movie theaters. But, you know, here on Feast of Fun, we love movies. We love documentaries. We're going to continue reporting on them and talking about them. Upcoming this week is we're going to take you behind the scenes on West Side Story 2.0 with director Esteban Spielbergo, who now is officially Puerto Rican. I loved West Side Story, and I think it's a fantastic film, but there's a lot of deeper nuances, a lot of complex stuff happening there, trying to redeem sort of the racism tied to the original film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some Puerto Ricans are not having it.
No.
They're like, why are you even trying to deal with this piece of shit? And other people are like, this is a masterpiece. This is a beautiful thing. And so their remake of America, you know, with Ariana DeBois from Hamilton is really just this fantastic, you know, musical number that captures that division there.
Foster, I really want to thank you for introducing me to Kirthi. I think she's really just such a special person in your life and my life. And it's great to get to know her over these years and have her come and talk to us about our life and our creative career with the podcast. It really, that means a lot because, you know, it's always wonderful. You know, Lady Gaga says it's like, as long as you have like 99 people in a room or 100 people in a room, 99 people won't believe in you, but that one person does. It really makes it all worthwhile. And I feel like Kirthi's always there for you in that corner. And I think she's awakened a lot of stuff in you, or a lot of great ideas in your life over the years. And it's so important to keep those kind of people close to you, especially, you know, the holidays are upon us, and it's great to bring those people in near and dear to your life.
So I feel the same way about you.
Thank you. And about you, of course.
And
you
the listeners.
That's why I married you.
Yeah.
And the listeners. And if you get a chance, go back into the archives and listen to the podcast, one of her first appearances, talking about 9/11 and taking the train into the city, coming up and seeing buildings collapse and running from rubble and dust. It's powerful and it's moving.
What a gift. Yeah. And I hope that everybody listening has a person like that in their lives. That, you know, plays that function for them. Mm-hmm. Seek those kind of people out, cultivate those relationships. Yeah. And we're so glad that you guys, 16 years later, 3,001 shows later, are here with us listening to Feast of Fun, supporting this podcast, making it possible. You can access all our archives at feastoffun.com/plus and, you know, consider becoming a member, and you can rest assured you're going to be the first person knowing about all our shows. You're going to access uninterrupted, no ads, all the podcasts. You get your own private RSS feed for just pennies a serving.
Pennies a serving.
Pennies a serving.
Pennies a serving. And you know, we're here as a testament to the people that took the time out of their day to sign up and become a Plus member. No, we couldn't do it without you. Or maybe you'd like to make a one-time donation. You can do that at feastoffun.com/donate or follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.